There were fears that public pressure would compel legislative response. Heaven forbid that this should occur in a democracy. The beneficiaries of corporate social responsibility were selected for maximum effect. Corporate managers who lent financial support were well aware that they were ingratiating themselves with recipients or pacifying a pressuring public. A corporate gift can be a bribe paid in return for a gadfly group's promise to keep still and refrain from criticizing corporate policies. On the other hand, quote, some business givers have withheld grants from groups identified with causes they consider to be too militant or unfriendly to corporate interests, close quote. For some, the success of another round of corporate social responsibility was a foregone conclusion. The social responsibility payoff has been attested to time and again. The most patent cost justification is a simple matter of good stickmanship, sidestepping the penalties of social irresponsibility, close quote. The judicious distribution of corporate money, quote, has allowed the managers to become brokers of social power, deciding which programs are supported and which are not, close quote. The language is vivid: bribe, ingratiate, satisfy the community, pay off, brokers of social power. How much plainer can it get? In all cases, control was the goal. Control not just of groups or movements, but of ideas and debates. Coupled with brutal suppression, this three-step strategy, placate, co-opt, reframe the debate, was used early and often. It worked after the 60s-70s wave of public uproar. Before that, it worked in the 1950s. It worked during the Depression. It worked during the wave of, quote, unrest immediately after World War I. In the late 19th century, an early version of it worked after corporate strategists got a glimpse of the Knights of Labor and the populace. The notions of corporate trusteeship, the civic duty of a corporation, corporate citizenship, corporate social responsibility, and the corporate social audit all originated in the desire of corporate managers to thwart unionization, forestall revolt, avoid government action, and above all, retain control by shaping public debate. Each time corporate managers, hiding behind the increasingly powerful shield of the legal fiction of the corporation, took another step toward becoming a more powerful, semi-autonomous managerial elite, they cranked up the public relations machinery to boast of the corporation's deep concern and caring for the community. Increasingly, they doled out goodies, always on their terms and in their terms. So successfully have these terms become part of our political language that they often go unnoticed. Why is it, for instance, that when a government using money collected for the public good aids needy citizens, they're on the dole, a supposed disgrace? But when corporate managers give away other people's money to a soup kitchen, it's philanthropy. If you doubt that corporate managers and not regular folks define the terms of public debate today, you might ask yourself these questions. Who defines free trade? What about welfare reform? Or those dubious twins, tree harvest and deer harvest? Remember, jobs versus environment, a golden oldie that never seems to fade away. These terms and the terms of the debate were all brought to us by corporate managers. Corporate managers are willing and eager to participate in the democratic process, but only if they are in charge of it. When it comes to being subject to it, they balk and are in fact willing to do anything, anything, even give away a little corporate money, in order to avoid losing control over the way issues are framed, thus becoming subject to the democratic process. Corporate managers of the 70s warned their comrades that failure to act would have horrific consequences. The alternatives are not attractive. The likeliest possibility is the wholesale substitution of public for private goals, strategies, and actions. The options were clear. Either institute the three-point plan, or the country will succumb to, I hope you're sitting down, a people's democracy. As night follows day, corporate managers experienced great surges of corporate social responsibility following each historic episode of social unrest. Such bouts of corporate good citizenship are voluntary, calculated, expedient, cheap, and temporary. Far from reflecting democratic control, they frustrate it. Meaningless, unenforceable, side agreements are not concessions to democracy on the part of corporate managers, but concessions to lack of democracy on the part of a not sovereign people. So it must be an especially sweet moment for corporate managers looking up from their Courvoisier glazed snifters to hear people clamoring for corporate social responsibility. That strategy with a thousand faces that has served to solidify the grip of the corporate elite through a century of citizen protests. With the echoes of WTO Week in Seattle still rumbling in our ears, we have another opportunity to firmly reject the corporate social responsibility ruse. A small but growing core of people is demanding not goodies or favors or good deeds, but real self-governance. They know that recovering goodies from worried corporate managers is the real dole, while a self-governing people controlling their community's resources in the interest of society as a whole, that is democracy. And that article was Corporate Social Responsibility, Kick the Habit, by Jane Ann Morris, from the book Defying Corporations, Defining Democracy, a book of history and strategy, published by POCLAD, the Program on Corporations, Law, and Democracy. And the book was published in 2001, so that article was written not that long after the WTO protests in Seattle.
You have meddled with the primal forces of nature, and I won't have it! Is that clear? You are an old man who thinks in terms of nations and peoples. There are no nations. There are no peoples. There are no Russians. There are no Arabs. There are no third worlds. There is no West. There is only one holistic system of systems. One vast and immane, interwoven, interacting, multivariate, multinational dominion of dollars. Petrodollars, electrodollars, multidollars, Reichmarks, rims, rubles, pounds, and shekels. It is the international system of currency which determines the totality of life on this planet. That is the natural order of things today. That is the atomic and subatomic and galactic structure of things today. And you have meddled with the primal forces of nature. And you will atone.
Am I getting through to you?
You get up and howl about America and democracy. There is no America. There is no democracy. There is only IBM and ITT and AT&T and DuPont, Dow, Union Carbide, and Exxon. Those are the nations of the world today. The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business.
It has been since man crawled out of the slime. And our children will live to see that perfect world in which there's no war or famine, oppression or brutality. One vast and ecumenical holding company, whom all men serve, in which all men will hold a share of stock. All necessities provided, all anxieties tranquilized, all boredom amused.
Just think about the power and the money. Come be smart, come be rational. The future belongs to the transnational. Better to win than be beaten. Better to eat than be eaten. Don't resist us, don't even try. Come on over to the winning side.
This article is titled Regarding the Journal of Corporate Citizenship by Jim Price. I recently ran across a flyer advertising the Journal of Corporate Citizenship. Such terms as corporate citizenship and corporate responsibility reflect a deference to corporate language that I find disturbing. Corporate executives like to throw around terms like corporate citizenship and corporate citizen. Corporations cannot be citizens. Only natural persons can be citizens. Corporations are artificial entities created under the authority of laws and acted by natural persons, we the people acting as citizens. Corporate officials also like to talk about corporate responsibility. That term implies that we the people should leave to corporate managers the right to define what constitutes responsible corporate behavior. I believe that such determinations are solely the right of we the people, not of corporate officials. We natural persons should determine the standards to be met by all economic enterprises, whether those enterprises are organized in corporate, partnership, cooperative, or any other form. We the people, not corporate officials, should determine what constitutes impossible corporate behavior. Then corporations and their officials should be held accountable to the environmental, workplace safety, community health, workers' rights, human rights, and other standards established by we the people. We set the bar. We govern, not the corporations. We define the privileges which we will allow corporations to exercise and the limits to those privileges. We hold them accountable to our defined standards, not theirs. This is the origin of the concept of corporate accountability. This is why I think the language that is used in communicating about abuses of wealth and power is very important. Terms like corporate citizenship and corporate responsibility are corporate inventions, terms implying a deference by we the people to corporate officials of our right to define what constitutes citizenship and responsibility. Corporate accountability, on the other hand, retains the power in the hands of we the people where it belongs. We must be careful not to allow ourselves to become captive of corporate language, and to help others understand the distinction among the implications associated with the use of such terms as corporate citizen, corporate responsibility, and corporate accountability. And that article, Regarding the Journal of Corporate Citizenship, by Jim Price. Our next article is titled Consumption, Civil Action, and Corporate Power, Lessons from the Past, Strategies for the Future, by Ward Morehouse. Simon Zadek and Frank Amalric, in their essay Consumer Works, argue that consumption-based civil activism can be one of the, quote, transforming drivers in the struggle to move the world onto a more sustainable path of development. They qualify this proposition with the words, at least in part. It's hard to disagree with their proposition so qualified. The key question then becomes, how significant is that part attributable to consumption-based civil activism? Before turning to the critical question, it is necessary to understand some of the startling changes that have been occurring in the global political economy and which have substantial impact on patterns of global consumption. The picture that emerges is one of largely unmitigated bad news if the ultimate and overriding goal is to create a more environmentally and socially sustainable future. What has been happening in recent decades has been an accelerating drive toward creating a global consumer culture through the increasing concentration of wealth and power in giant corporations larger than most nation states. The role of corporations. The annual revenues of the 500 largest corporations in the world, the Global 500, are some $10 trillion, around twice the size of the gross domestic product of the United States, the biggest economy in the world. In a single year, 1994, the Global 500 revenues increased by 9% and profits soared by a colossal 62%. The Global 500 in that same year eliminated 262,000 jobs. Even more striking is the startling rate of capital accumulation among the top 200 global corporations. Quote, the velocity of transnationalization of capital, as measured as share of world GDP, writes Frederick Claremont, is stunning. From 17% in the mid-1960s to 24% in 1982, and over 32% in 1995, close quote. The drive to create a global consumer culture and its impact on our increasingly stressed biosphere have been well documented in a number of recent books. Given the enormous concentration of wealth and power in the boardrooms of giant corporations and their determined effort to lock us all into unsustainable patterns of consumption, resistance on a global scale has been largely uncommensurate. Civil activism and the watchdog role. Zadek and Amalric suggest that civil activism may have played a not unimportant, quote, watchdog role in instances involving sweatshop labor by the Gap or Nike corporations, and environmental destruction and violations of human rights of indigenous peoples by the British Petroleum Corporation in Colombia and Shell Corporation in Nigeria. Since the thrust of their essay is to link consumption with civil action, I assume they have in mind boycotts in one form or another. While the threat of consumer backlash, stimulated by unfavorable publicity, may have played some role in those cases, other strategies not necessarily linked to consumption have also been involved. For example, the litigation in the case of British Petroleum and Shell, and governmentally sanctioned codes of conduct with monitoring, if not enforcement, mechanisms. But there seems to me to be little evidence, so far at least, of any transforming impact on these corporations. Let us look at two other examples with a longer time horizon to illustrate a countervailing proposition, namely, that attempts to affect corporate behavior by making it less unsustainable, however that may be defined, are likely to be transitory in impact unless they diminish the structures of power that sustain these corporations. Making corporate behavior sustainable? Consider what happened after the Union Carbide Corporation caused the worst industrial disaster in history when its pesticide plant gassed the sleeping city of Bhopal in India, killing 10 to 20,000. We shall never know the exact number, and injuring hundreds of thousands more. After the disaster, Carbide's management recognized that it was vulnerable to boycotts of the corporation's consumer products, and as one element in their response to the massive human tragedy, divested the corporation of its consumer products. This was done ostensibly as part of the Carbide management's defense against a hostile takeover bid by another chemical company. However, there is little doubt in the minds of those of us who have been supporting the struggle for justice by the Bhopal victims that insulating the corporation from a possible consumer backlash over Bhopal was also a critical determinant in this divestment action. By the time those divestments were effected, Union Carbide Corporation announced to the world that it had become an industrial company, meaning that it sold goods and services only to other industrial companies, which in effect screened Carbide from consumption-based civil activism. Of course, a divestment strategy as a means of insulating a corporation from consumption-based civil action is not equally available to all large corporations. But as long as corporations of this size are essentially sovereign entities capable of transforming themselves into whatever form their management decides, they have the potential for diffusing this type of civil action. Or consider the case of Nestle S.A. Corporation and its infant formula products. During the 1980s, a worldwide campaign was mounted to prohibit Nestle and other manufacturers of infant formula from marketing their products in an aggressive and deceptive manner in third world countries. One of the seemingly great triumphs of consumer-based civil activism was the adoption of a code for marketing infant formula to developing countries by the World Health Organization and its acceptance by Nestle. But what happened subsequently surely must have been discouraging to those who led this worldwide campaign. The Nestle SA Corporation discovered, quote-unquote, loopholes in the, quote, code of conduct large enough for them to resume the previously used deceptive marketing practices. Indeed, the Nestle SA Corporation actions had become so blatant that UNICEF felt compelled to initiate a baby-friendly hospital initiative to counter this behavior. The UNICEF initiative advocated that third world countries adopt legislation prohibiting such marketing of infant formula and establish public and professional education measures aimed at assuring effective implementation of such legislation. Lessons to consider. The lesson which emerges from these and other similar examples is that consumption-based civil actions are not likely to become transforming drivers unless they address the roots of corporate power and in some fundamental way alter the distribution of political and economic power in today's world. Since corporations can continue to rule the world only as long as they are able to sell their goods and services, it seems entirely plausible, in theory, to argue that consumer-based civil actions could be transforming drivers in moving the world toward a more sustainable path of development. After all, we are, all of us consumers, complicit in maintaining corporate dominance of the global political economy. If we would all simultaneously stop buying the products of a given corporation, we would put it out of business. The frequency with which consumer boycotts occur, only one form of consumer-based activism to be sure, but a widely used form, is reflected in the pages of the U.S.-based publication Boycott Quarterly. It lists dozens, if not hundreds, of consumer boycotts in progress at any given moment, but few of them appear to achieve any transforming effect on their proclaimed targets. So at least this form of consumption-based civil action remains attractive in theory, but extremely difficult to practice. Nonetheless, ending corporate rule will need to reach well beyond consumption-based civil activism, even though such activism can certainly play a significant role. The largest corporations in the world today are simply too big to be subject to the meaningful democratic control, which I would argue is essential to building a more just and sustainable social order. Any realistic strategy to achieve this goal must come to grips with the need for dismantling these global giants. And that was Consumption, Civil Action, and Corporate Power, Lessons from the Past, Strategies for the Future by Ward Morehouse, from the book Defying Corporations, Defining Democracy, a book of history and strategy. As Morehouse alluded to in the article, corporations are ultimately vulnerable because they gain their revenue, which is their lifeblood, from buying and selling. The problem with boycotts, as they are usually employed, is that they seek to influence a particular corporation's behavior, not to destroy corporations and the economic system they rule altogether. Last week, one of the speakers defined economics as a means of providing for the home, in other words, the ability to live. An economic strategy commensurate with the legal strategy our speakers have been discussing must contest for power and make us stronger individually and collectively while weakening corporations. What follows are a few simple tips of things that you can do as an individual that are easy and legal, that not only deny the system your money, but increase networks of cooperation and solidarity, as well as benefiting people and planet in other ways. Okay, so the bottom line is the bottom line. The system of money and credit is the means by which people are enslaved to the system. Every time we give them our money, we weaken ourselves and strengthen them. For-profit banks take our money and use it against us. It's almost impossible these days to live without a bank account. So move yours to a credit union, which is a not-for-profit mutual assistance organization in which you are a member, not a consumer. Buy used things instead of new wherever you can. Repair things rather than buy new ones wherever you can. Better yet, barter, and even better, get involved in gifting networks like FreeCycle. Create networks to share expensive but seldom used tools and equipment with your neighbors or your friends. This can be anything from a power saw to a car. Grow your own organic food to whatever extent you can. Every little bit helps. get the rest of it from farmers markets, CSAs, and food co-ops that buy locally. Big box retailers like Walmart have been actively engaged in driving locally owned shopkeepers out of business for a long time. The problem such small businesses face is that the items they sell usually come from the same sources as those sold in the big box, because most manufacturing has been outsourced and is not local. The corporations have gone wherever they may abuse workers the most and pollute with the least interference. The small businesses are not able to sell these items as cheaply as the chain stores because of the economies of scale. Here's a way you can use credit cards to help level the playing field a little. Now, these credit cards should be paid in full every month so that you don't pay interest to use them. If you must shop at a big box because there is no alternative, use a credit card because the merchant is charged a percentage of the sale every time you use it. Credit cards drive costs up and they pass it on to consumers with higher prices. When you shop at a local non-corporate merchant, use cash or checks because there are no fees. If enough people do this, you will chip away at the competitive edge the big boxes have in pricing. If you must buy something on credit, as people who have little money often have to, get a credit card from your credit union to use for such purposes. For use in the big box stores, use a different card that you'll pay in full each month. I have been told that Discover has the highest merchant fees of the various cards. You can, of course, eliminate using credit cards altogether, but that is difficult for most people because of the way things are set up. My last economic harassment tip was suggested to me by a friend who gets enormous pleasure using this to retaliate against all the credit card companies that send her junk mail solicitations. These solicitations always include business reply envelopes, which are first class rate. That's 44 cents right now. She mails them back empty. This seems trivial, but imagine those costs multiplied by many millions. I'm sure if you put your mind to it, you can think of some other ways to economically harass corporations and have fun at the same time. The suggestions I've made amount to a lot of money taken out of corporate hands if millions of people do them simultaneously. You could set a goal of how much money per month you are going to deprive corporations of and keep track of it. Get together and do this with your friends. Maybe agree to meet once a month and make dinner together and report on the ways and amounts you have diverted money from their profit stream. That could be fun. And it would show you how people who have little money individually represent a lot of money when we work in concert. Every dollar you deprive them of is a dollar less they have to pay their lobbyists and lawyers to make laws to keep you in serfdom.
Some have said it is the bastard offspring of the legendary feudal bloodsucker. But I believe it was created when corporations were declared legal people.
Legal people?
It was 1886, a little-known land use case here in California. Lawyers for Southern Pacific Railroad argued that the 14th Amendment, which declared slaves free and equal citizens, should be extended to corporations.
Corporations?
Yes. A superior court judge agreed, and corporations became legal people with many of the rights of you or I, yet they are immortal.
Immortal?
They feed on tax breaks, bailouts, and the privatization of public wealth. And in power seems to be growing.
Professor, this is preposterous.
More preposterous than corporations running welfare systems.
Oh, well, I never said
tax breaks for billion-dollar companies, no. While social services crumble. No human would create such horrors. Only the inhuman mind of the bloodsucker.
In our last segment, we'll hear a presentation from Tom Lindsay of the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. He's been helping communities draft and pass local laws revoking corporate personhood and corporate rights. He recently served as a consultant to the people of Ecuador in incorporating rights for nature into their new constitution.
As you can imagine, we do a lot of conferences across the United States. We talk to a lot of people in a lot of places. That all of these issues have a common denominator among them. And that common denominator is that we seem not to be able to make any decisions at the local level that stick anymore. And in fact, those decisions about sustainability and about, you know, protecting nature and about protecting our authority to democratically govern ourselves and our community to build sustainable communities at the local level, about what we think our vision should be as experts ourselves who live in the community, who have the most knowledge about how that community operates and what's best for that community. I'm not going to start talking about water tonight. I'm actually going to start talking about mining. In western Pennsylvania, one of our communities got sued about a month ago. And this is coal country in western Pennsylvania. I don't know if anybody's spent a good bit of time there, but a lot of coal's been pulled out of the ground in western Pennsylvania. And with that pulling out of the ground in western Pennsylvania has come a lot of damage, in those communities. You drive through them, you see the slag piles. There are three elected officials, similar to your select boards. We have in Pennsylvania Township Board of Supervisors. They're our smallest unit of government. The supervisors in these small units of government in Pennsylvania were essentially hired, and in fact the office of township began, as a way to take care of the roads. So these folks in the townships actually run the snow plows in the winter and they patch the roads in the summer. That's what they do, and they get paid about $3,700 a year to do it. Some folks in western Pennsylvania have gotten pretty upset with something that began about 10 years ago, which is called longwall coal mining. I don't know if anybody's ever heard of longwall mining, but it used to be that in western Pennsylvania, to dig coal out of the ground, you would do something called room and pillar. So these big corporations would come in, folks that own the coal reserves up and down the East Coast and through the coal anthracite bituminous regions, that the corporations would come in, and their miners employed by the corporation would go in and do room and pillar mining, which means they'd evacuate the coal out, and then they'd leave pillars in place to hold the ground up. Because if you don't leave the pillars in place, guess what happens? Houses and roads and streams and rivers and everything else, they just collapse into those holes. About 10 years ago, they came up with a new thing. It's much more efficient in the coal industry. And the coal companies called longwall coal mining, where huge machines actually run under the surface of the ground to harvest the coal. What happens as the machines move through is that they pull the surface support behind the machines as they're moving through. And something that we use this nice sounding word for called subsidence happens, which is the land behind where the coal machine is running through drops sometimes 6 to 8 feet into the holes. And what happens at that point is that those areas that have been longwall mined, they lose their streams and their rivers. They actually crack the limestone when the subsidence occurs. And so where a stream once ran, nothing does. And in fact, when somebody actually makes a coal company has repaired the streams or attempt to, they actually come in and caulk them with cement. They caulk the streams to try to keep the leakage from occurring. Absolutely amazing stuff. You would think that in Pennsylvania, the Department of Environmental Protection, which is our version of the DES in New Hampshire, and I forget what it's called here, DEP here in Maine, absolutely excellent, that the Department of Environmental Protection, you would think in Pennsylvania, would say, wow, this is not great because we're losing our streams and rivers and it's damaging everything in western Pennsylvania. We got to step in and do something about it. Well, it turns out that the Department of Environmental Protection permits it to happen. They write in subsidence into the permits that they issue for the coal companies. They write it in. It's not called permitting for nothing. It permits something to happen. It legalizes something to happen. And guess who wrote the regulations that the DEP operates under? The coal companies. Planning Commission member in western Pennsylvania, a good friend of ours named Michael Vacca, he likes to use a phrase. He says, coal is king. says it doesn't matter what the Pennsylvania Constitution says, doesn't matter what the DEP regulations say, doesn't matter what state law says about people being protected or local government being able to make their own rules. Doesn't matter, because coal's king. I think in some ways water is becoming king in some areas. What did these folks do in Western Pennsylvania? They passed an ordinance. But before they passed the ordinance, they went through something that we've referred to as democracy school, which is a three-day training that we run to give people the bad news. And the bad news is that the system of government and structure of law that we think we have in this country really doesn't exist when you actually attempt to use it to protect your community. Because these folks in Western Pennsylvania went through the democracy school, didn't like what they heard, and they said, hey, we think we have a right to local self-government here in Western Pennsylvania. Structure of law in the last 100 years really belies that fact, because as Mari said, believe it or not, the law in the United States today is if something's been deemed to be a legal use, L-E-G-A-L, a legal use, water withdrawals, legal uses, corporate pork production, legal use, low-level radioactive waste disposal, legal use, toxic waste incinerators, legal use, you get the picture. Most everything is a legal use because it's permitted by the state. If something's been deemed a legal use, once again, L-E-G-A-L, that communities are prohibited from banning it. Okay? Legal use, prohibited from banning it. It's a status of the law. Doesn't matter whether you ask the corporate lawyers, the environmental lawyers, doesn't matter what lawyers you ask on either side of the fence, they'll tell you the same thing. It's been well-settled law for the past 100 years. Legal use, can't ban it. Some people at that point in democracy schools always say, well, that's not true. We have zoning ordinances, and through the zoning ordinances, you can ban a certain use. Well, not quite. Under the zoning ordinances, which are land use laws, you can separate out incompatible land uses, like commercial from industrial from residential. You attempt to use a zoning ordinance to ban illegal use. You're looking at a big, fat lawsuit from the corporation whose rights under the law you have just violated. So what did these folks do in Western Pennsylvania? They were looking at the destruction of their township because they're over this big thing called the Buffalo Coal Reserve, which is owned by about 5 different corporations who can't wait to get their fingers into it. These Blaine Township supervisors, a little place called Blaine Township in Washington County, no more than 500 people living in Blaine, looked at the existing law, looked at the regulatory structure, saw to themselves that the best thing they were going to get out of investing time in the regulatory and permitting structure was things like buffer zones and decibel levels maybe controlled a couple hours a day, but it certainly wasn't going to allow them to say no to coal coming out of the ground. They did it because they had no other choice but to do something different. Because if they had stuck with the same activism, the same stuff that we've been doing for 40 years in this country, to try to stop the bad things from assaulting our community and then cleaning them up afterwards, that they said to themselves, we have to do something different here. They had no other place left to turn. So they came to democracy school. And what they heard in democracy school wasn't us promoting X, Y, and Z. What they heard in democracy school was us talking about history. It's pretty dry to some folks. They always still think democracy school is pretty dry. But we go back to the 1600s. In fact, we go back to 1066. Because what we have in this country is a constitutional structure of law, Mari was talking about, which actually incorporated something called English common law. That's what we used as the platform, the DNA, for our own constitution. And guess what? That law actually places the rights of property and commerce. Keep in mind, water is commerce, mining is commerce, incineration is commerce, garbage is commerce, you name it. Over the rights of people, communities, and nature. That's DNA'd into the law. That's the structure of law that we have. Okay, it's a lot of stuff, and see, somebody's calling us on it already. So what happened in Blaine Township, and why is it relevant to you folks? Well, they decided to pass an ordinance, and their ordinance looks a lot like Barnstead's ordinance. It looks a lot like Nottingham's ordinance. Because guess what? Because what happens is when we actually try to stand up and say, we don't want that. Our vision of a sustainable community does not include a 15,000 head hog factory farm in the middle of it, or being undermined to the point where we lose all of our streams and rivers in our community. It doesn't include running dry because somebody's coming in to pop and drill our pump, our aquifer. Doesn't include that. Well, it turns out if you want to say no to coal mining, in your community, you don't want to say no to this corporation coming in to rip out the coal. You run into the same structural and legal hurdles that you folks run into when you want to say no to some corporation coming into your community. It's exactly the same because it's a script. In Pennsylvania, we passed a number of years ago something called the Water Resources Management Act, which was essentially companies wanting to come into Pennsylvania to pump water and big agribusiness concerns wanting to pump water for these factory farms in mid-state Pennsylvania. What they did was they came in 2 years before and they wrote a law that essentially was supposed to regulate them, but they were the ones that authored it. So that when we want to do something in our community and we're told the best you can do is work within the regulatory system, and we look at that regulatory system, and number one, it doesn't allow us to say no to something coming in, but number two, it wasn't even written by us. It wasn't even written by us. And if we think those boys, the corporate boys, were actually looking out for us when they wrote the regulatory structures underneath which we work, we must be crazy, because they wrote it to extract. They wrote it to extract with the least possible interference from the communities in which they're seeking to do business in. The story was always the same for communities like yours. Water Corporation would come in. They would put a site application in. They'd put a permit application in. The community would organize. They would call a lawyer, usually an environmental lawyer, and the environmental lawyer would deliver the bad news to you, which is to say, you can't stop it. In other words, you can't pass an ordinance that says no water withdrawal. But what you can do with our help, and you give us a $5,000 retainer, and we'll be more than happy to help you, that what you can do with our help is we'll try to stop it through the regulatory process. We'll work within the regulatory process and try to stop it through there by making it too expensive for the corporation, or taking up too much time, so the corporation goes someplace else. Always about going someplace else, never about stopping it or saying no within the regulatory structure. The Water Corporation, which has, of course, law firms on retainer, in addition to lobbyists running around your legislature, quite a few lobbyists from what I hear running around your legislature, that these folks just wait you out in the unlikely event that there's actually a community group that stands up in the first place, because most of these communities, there's no community group organized at all, and so these boys just come in and they pump. That's how it works. If you do something in your community using the standard tools that you have, like zoning ordinances, to try to stop the pumping, they sue you, and they win. And they win because there's another nasty little secret. Corporations have constitutional rights, to which usually people say, well, what the hell does that mean? Corporation of constitutional rights. Well, guess what? Everything our ancestors fought for, that we thought we drove into the Declaration of Independence about people being the source of all governing authority. Look it up. It's in your constitution. It's in Pennsylvania's constitution. It's in all our constitutions, right? Turns out that those rights were actually seized by corporations about 140 years ago. And corporations were found in the U.S. Constitution, which means that they have Bill of Rights protections. They have First Amendment free speech protections, just like you or I. They have Fifth Amendment due process takings protections, which means that if you attempt to pass an ordinance that says, no, you can't drill for water here, they bring a Fifth Amendment constitutional claim against your community, contending not only does the ordinance or the decision that you've made violate their corporate constitutional rights, it also allows them to sue you for lost future profits as damages. So that you're facing not only an overturning of your decision, warrant, article, or ordinance, you're facing damages that you have to pay for their lawyers, i.e. attorney's costs, plus damages that the corporation has suffered as a result of you passing that ordinance. Right? It's the same stuff. 4 weeks ago, lawsuit comes delivered by the sheriff to the Blaine Township, Washington County Board of Supervisors. And it's the same claims. It's like the corporate lawyers, the corporate boys. They have a boilerplate on their computers. They just have empty spaces, and they fill in the spaces, right? Fill it in with Wells or fill it in with Blaine Township. Doesn't matter. It's very easy being a corporate lawyer because you have all these buttons. You have a big chart, and you just push the buttons because the boys have developed this law over the past 140 years, and they just hit the buttons. It's so easy for them to do. What Barnstead did as the first community in the United States to stand up and pass a binding ordinance that said, not here. We're not going to do it here. We're not going to run rings around this regulatory system. We're not going to spend money and exhaust ourselves within a system that was not intended and never was intended to provide us a remedy. What we're going to do here is say no. And we're going to say no creatively, because we're going to go after the corporate actors that are coming in. Because it's these boys who contend that 5 or 7 or 11 people sitting on their board of directors have more rights than you. Have more rights than you, than a majority of people in the community. That 5, 7, or 11 people, however many people sitting on the board of directors, have more rights than you. That's what they argue in court. The unfortunate part is, for the most part, they're right, because that's how the structure of law is set up. Barnstead said, we're not going to do that. We're not going to do that. We're going to turn the tables, right? And so the Blaine Townships of the world, and there's actually a Wells Township in Fulton County in South Central Pennsylvania, the Wells Townships of the world, that something invisible stitches all these communities together. If they were running singly, they would get crushed. But what you're beginning to see in this country is what we think is the beginning of something big. It's a constitutional movement of some sorts to change the fundamental structure of law under which we live. That's what we think what we're seeing. Because it's not just one sticking their head up, it's 100. You know? In Pennsylvania, it's over 100 communities that have passed ordinances of this sort. People in Blaine Township, just to get to Blaine before we finish up here, people in Blaine Township could have backed down. They could have said, oh my God, we've been sued, and the lawsuit's going to cost some money, and that means we have to repeal our ordinance. But they didn't. They said, we're going to move ahead. And now they're defending that ordinance. They've hired us to represent them in the federal district court, and we're for the first time arguing in federal court that the right to local self-government actually is dominant to the right of the corporation to come in to rip that township apart. The corporate boys, the lawyers, the CEOs, the board of directors, they laugh at you. I've been in those rooms. They laugh at you. They think it's extraordinarily funny that communities would dare to dream that they have the right to make the rules in their own communities. I've been in the rooms with the sludge, big sludge companies, and they think it's hilarious. And they get together weekly. You know, we have democracy schools. We run about 3,000 people through them. We've taught about 190 of them. These boys have democracy schools every week. And they meet by phone, and they meet in person. And they talk about how best to override you. Right? How best to perfect those tools. And in some way, those boys have been meeting for the past 100 years, and by God, they've got the thing together, stitched together pretty well at this point, between their constitutional rights, their elimination of your local government rights under something called Dillon's Rule, which essentially says your municipality is in some ways a child to the state as a parent, and that the state has the ability to override you. All these different legal theories that have been concocted. You can open the books and read them. They don't make any sense. The Democracy School attendees try to make sense out of it, to which we look back in the and we say, it doesn't seem fair, does it? Because it's not. And there's no logic to it. The only logic to it is that those with the money make the rules. And the rules have been made to screw you and for these folks to come in and do that. So they laugh at you, and I've been in those rooms. And the other final piece here is that, and sometimes this is very difficult to hear, is that there's nobody out there to help you. There's nobody out there to help you. A lot of the work that we do and a lot of the work that communities across this country do is based on hope. And that hope is based that there's somebody that's going to come in to help you. Maybe it's the Sierra Club, maybe it's the legislature, maybe it's the regulatory agencies, maybe it's someone that's going to come in to actually help you. And what we've learned over the past 10 years is that there ain't nobody that's going to help you. This is a whole new road to travel. It can't be traveled just because you think it's neat and cool. It can't be traveled just because somebody tells you it's a good idea. It's got to be traveled because you've come to the conclusion yourselves that you have no other option to get what you want. Having said that, if you've come to that conclusion, we're here to provide some help. Which means that we can use the ordinances that we've developed before, we can use the experience of these communities from across the nation, We're more than willing to help you in answering questions. A lot of this is talking to other people about why do this, because they want to know why should we engage in this ordinance, why should we take the risk, all those things. And so a lot of this is about talking to other people about what this stuff is. One of the segments that we teach in democracy school is about prior people's movements. If people had not challenged the status of the law, separate but equal would still be the law in the United States. Women would still not be entitled to vote. I mean, we can go back through all those theories that have been changed by massive movements of people from the bottom up. And just to leave you with this thought, because it's one of the most damning ones that we play with in the democracy school, but corporations became persons for constitutional purposes before women became persons in this country. Corporations became persons under the Constitution back in 1886. Women, through the 19th Amendment in 1920, received the right to vote, which wasn't quite constitutional equal protection due process rights, but corporations became persons before women became persons in this country. So that's the struggle, that's the haul, and we're here to help you. As for NAFTA and GATT, one of the things we talk about in democracy school is that our U.S. Constitution's Commerce Clause, which is this relatively innocuous-looking five or six words in the U.S. Constitution, which allow private corporations to sue you to overturn laws that restrict commerce. Keep in mind, garbage is commerce, water is commerce. I mean, all different things have been defined as commerce as well. That exists too. So in Blaine Township, for example, the lawsuit that was filed said you're restricting interstate commerce, therefore you're violating the coal corporation's constitutional rights. That Commerce Clause was actually used as the model to develop NAFTA and GATT and the International Trade Tribunals, because it's all about a higher power located furthest away from the community that's being impacted that actually has the authority to overturn through the courts and the trade tribunals limitations on commerce within the community that's been passed. And so depending on the situation that you're in, it also means going up against these different structures of law as well. I mean, there's good news and everything. It's bad news as well. But it means taking on the whole enchilada, because once again, if you don't, you're going to get pumped. I mean, that's just the situation.
That was Tom Lindsay, founder of CellDef, speaking at a conference on defending water from corporate theft in Maine. The music used in the program this week was from the Mammon Tabernacle Choir and the San Francisco Mime Troupe, and our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. You can download this and all previous episodes of the show at unwelcomeguests.org. Thanks for listening.
Catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle will always be filled by unwelcome travelers.